Good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net, courtesy of the WA7ABU529 repeater. Before I get started, could I get a quick signal check on my commence room?
Brett, you're coming through loud and clear. KI7FWH.
Okay, great. I want to make sure I was hearing weird noises. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Sorry, I didn't sign there. My name's Brett, and I'm net control for this evening. March 17th, 2020, St. Patrick's Day. This net meets each Tuesday evening, lately, from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz. This is a designated emergency frequency, so we'll break if any real emergency occurs. Our ultimate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have clear frequency for the next hour as we discuss emergency preparedness, and tonight's emphasis will be on the COVID-19 incident, which we are following. We started 2 weeks ago, and a lot of things are happening and changing. And anyway, that's the focus of tonight. I'll set a little bit of ground rules before we check in here. Yeah, so you know, in an emergency preparedness net, what we'd like to do is we want to exchange information, answer some questions. I've got a guest with us tonight. My wife is Sheila Sund, MD. She's a retired physician who worked on the pandemic planning committee, representing Marion County on the emergency preparedness for the state plan. Worked on other plans as far as disaster preparedness. Has authored a lot of series of articles in our Marion County Medical Society newsletter, and she has a blog that she has just started up on. So the first thing I'm going to send you to is we're going to send you to disasterdoc.net, and that is Delta, India, Sierra, Alpha, Sierra, Tango, Echo, Romeo, Delta, Oscar, Charlie, dot, November, Echo, Tango. So disasterdoc, all one word, .net. That is her blog. There is a recent blog which is about the COVID-19 and why this is a kind of a different thing, and talking a little bit about, there's some background information about what's happening now with regard to preparing for a medical surge and what we need to do, why we need to act quickly and collectively to help prevent the spread of this illness. So she's got a lot of information. She's been following this since January. When she first noted this, we've been actually practicing our own preparedness plan since about February 1st, when she first started reading the data. And so she's looked a lot at the actual individual data as it came out and how it's evolved, and can explain a lot of things to people if they have questions about where this stuff, how to interpret the numbers that you see and the response and what have you. So, you know, if she'll be there for questions, we'll send you again to that disasterdoc.net webpage. Get a little bit of background reading, start on that tonight. Let me get a break. Again, although this is, wrapped up worldwide with a lot of political things, I try not to make this political discussion. There will be some comments about how what our particular area is doing as far as the government goes, but, in terms of interpreting government decrees and the latest news as far as what we're supposed to be doing. But, we're not here to discuss controversies or who's to blame or whatever. That doesn't matter at this point in time. What we're here to talk about is to answer your questions that you have about the COVID-19 pandemic, and to share ideas and that will help us be better prepared in this emergency. Okay, so I'm getting another trip. Again, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. You have the emergency preparedness net. That being said, let's do some check-ins. We'll start by checking in stations that would like to participate or maybe just listen in on the discussions. We want to have time to address the questions. And so when you check in, please identify with your call sign slowly and phonetically, and also your name and location to be recognized by net control. Let me start first and see if there's any Echolink users that would like to check in. Echolink, come now, please. Okay, not hearing any Echolink users. So I'd take general check-ins for the Emergency Preparedness Net. Come now, please.
Good evening. This is Kilo Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango, Art and Canby.
Hello, Brett. Kilo Alpha 7, Juliet Lima Oscar, Jeff in Albany.
K9RCP, Richard in Dundee.
W7NAT, Nate in South Salem.
Kilo Golf 7, Golf Charlie Yankee, this is Lee in South Salem.
Good evening, Brett. November 0, November, November Oscar, Fred, Lafayette, and also check in Whiskey 4, Delta, Oscar X-ray, Nancy.
Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta, Richard Salem. And hi, Richard.
November Whiskey 7, Oscar Romeo. And November 7, Delta Kilo Bravo, Richard and Deborah in Albany.
Okay, let's pause there and welcome that group. There was Richard and Deborah, November Whiskey 7, Oscar Romeo, and November 7, Delta Kilo Bravo. Thank you for checking in. And then we have a bunch of Richards, three Richards in a row here. We have Richard in Salem, Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta. Thank you for checking in. And we have the other Richard, Whiskey 0, Echo Delta Foxtrot, or third first, Richard in Tiger. We have... Fred and Nancy, November 0, November, November Oscar, and Whiskey 4, Delta Oscar X-ray. And we had Lee, Kilo Golf 7, Golf Charlie Yankee. Lee is a cert person from South Salem here near the Sunnyside Lake Slope area. We have Nate, Whiskey 7, November Alpha Tango. Nate was to insert at the Morningside, or not Morningside, actually, over by the load up there, whatever they call that district there. And then we had another Richard, Kilo 9 Romeo Charlie Papa. Richard up in Dundee. Let me get drift. And then we had, Kilo Alpha 7, Juliet Lima Oscar, Jeff in Albany. And Kilo Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango, Art in Canby. Anybody else want to check in?
Kilo 5, Charlie Papa, Charlie Mike in Happy Valley.
Good evening, Brad. Whiskey 7, Charlie, Mike, Bruce.
Good evening, Kilo Golf 7, Charlie, Kilo Oscar, James.
Whiskey Alpha 9, Oscar, November, Yankee, David.
Hello, Brad. Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha, Bravo, Uniform.
Top of the evening, Kilo Bravo 7, Foxtrot Charlie Hotel, Charlie here in Albany.
Kilo Golf 7, Yankee Alpha Papa, Steve Salem.
Kilo Bravo 7, Foxtrot Charlie Hotel. There's Dan, Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha Bravo Uniform. Dan makes it possible for everything that we do here on the repeater. Thanks, Dan, for giving us a good resource here. We had David up in Washington, Camas Washington, Whiskey Alpha 9, Oscar November Yankee. Welcome. James checked in, Kilo Golf 7, Charlie, Kilo Oscar. We had Mike high on the hill in Happy Valley, Kilo 5, Charlie, Papa, Charlie. And I think that takes care of that group. Okay, let's see. I'm going to stop here for a bit. It's 10 after the hour, and I think we do want to get on with our topic. Was there any, I guess, announcements that we need to make for the good of the net before we get started here?
W7NAT.
Yes, sir. Nate, go ahead, please.
The last time they came on, you covered up a check-in.
Okay, well, let's take a couple. Was there a couple more check-ins? I'm sorry if I could double with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, Whiskey 7, Charlie, Mike, Bruce.
Kilo Golf 7, Yankee Apple Papa, Steve.
Yeah, sorry, I skipped you. I actually typed your name in, but I did somehow just skipped right to Mike there. But thank you for checking in there, Bruce from Dundee. Okay, anybody else want to check in?
Kilo Golf 7, Yankee Alpha, Papa, Steve.
Okay, hold on. Steve, could you do that again just a little bit slower? Was it Yankee Alpha, Papa, or come again, please?
That's correct. Kilo Golf 7, Yankee Alpha, Papa.
Okay, Steve, there, you were new for my logs. That took me a little bit to get you logged in there. Kilo Golf 7, Yankee Alpha, Papa. Steve, and you're in Salem, right?
That is correct. Thank you.
Okay, well, welcome, welcome. I always like new people. We have you, I think it was new tonight, and Nancy I haven't heard from before either, so that's great. We actually have 19 people tonight. Is there anybody else that wants to check in before we get going on our topic?
Good evening, Brett. This is November 0, Tango India Foxtrot, Mike in Salem.
Juliet 7, Mike India Yankee, Julia and Kaiser.
Okay, that was a bit of a double there. I think Julian Kaiser can come back again with your call. I got Mike, November 0, Tango India Foxtrot. I think you, Mike won the double. Come again, please.
Yeah, Kilo Juliet 7, Mike India Yankee, Julia.
Very good. That's Kilo Juliet 7, Mike India Yankee, Julia in Kaiser. Thank you for checking in. Well, there's 21 of us. This is great. I'm really pleased that everybody's going. Okay, so let's move on to our topic. I want to spend the whole night checking in here. But let's. I've got again a guest speaker tonight, she's third party here on the radio with us here. And I think we're going to talk about first, again, we've sent you to disasterdoc.net, which is her webpage. And we're talking tonight about COVID-19. How bad is it? And, I'm going to have her do a little bit of an introduction, and then we'll take some questions, okay? So I'm going to hand the mic over to Sheila here, Sheila Sund, MD. Here you go.
Hi, this is Sheila. I apologize if I make radio mistakes because radio is not my thing. However, I do know a lot about pandemic. I have been involved in disaster preparedness for a little over 10 years now, beginning with H1N1, when I wondered how my hospice program that I was the medical director of could help when we thought for a brief period of time we might actually run out of ventilators from that. Following that, I became involved at both a local and a state level on a variety of disaster things, including being one of the people on the work group that wrote Oregon's crisis care guidance for the health authority, specifically how does healthcare systems look at medical surge. I have been following COVID-19 because I learned a lot about pandemic by doing all that, and I've been following it since early January. I knew as of January 30th that it was going to be a problem, and we started our family preparedness then. I activated my family plan on February 25th, And I've just basically been sitting here watching it unfold since then, and with a little bit of horror, mostly just because this was all predictable, and yet, other than the few scientists and a few doctors out there, most people didn't seem to get it. Anyway, so let me just talk a little bit about why COVID-19 is being as bad as it is. I know a lot of people have thought, well, it's not much more than flu and all that kind of stuff. Part of that is because we said, well, most people just have mild symptoms. Mild, in this case, means not hospitalized. So mild, 81% of people have mild symptoms. That doesn't mean they're not sick as a dog. It means that they can be sick really bad for 14 days. They just don't end up in the hospital. But that means that worldwide, 19% of the people that catch this virus end up in the hospital, okay? And of that, somewhere between 25 to 30% of those require being on a ventilator in intensive care. If they can get that level of intensive care support and ventilators, they've been able to keep the fatality rate down to around a little over 2% for the entire population. But if you look at it by age, what they have found is even with all that intensive support, people between the ages of about 70 and 79, the fatality rate has been about 8%. And if you're 80 and above, the fatality rate has been 14.8%, even with all the hospitals can offer for you. So, what makes COVID-19 worse other than just that? Well, the biggest thing is really that these people need hospitalization. In a general flu season, at most, actually not general, a bad flu season, about 1% of the infected patients end up in the hospital, whereas we're at almost 20% needing the hospital, with a quarter of those in intensive care. The other problem is how quickly this virus is expanding throughout the world. We are starting to learn that there are a lot of people that carry it that don't have any symptoms whatsoever. That's really pretty brand new information, not surprising, but not proven before this. But basically, once you have one case in the community, it will double every 5 days. Doesn't sound that bad, but if you do the math, on day one, the first patient that got infected, that's one. On day 30, you only have about 100 people. That's not too bad, right? We can handle that. 45 days into it, you have 1,000 people that are sick. 60 days into it, you have 8,000 people sick. And if you don't do anything about it, by day 90, you have 500,000 people sick. So 3 months from one infection, 500,000 people sick, 20% of those needing the hospital. So that's why everybody is so freaked out. We don't have very many hospital beds, and we don't have very many critical care beds. In the United States, if we turned every bed we possibly could into a critical care bed, we would have about 94,000 critical beds. If only 5% of the if we just imagined 1% of the United States got this bug and 5% got critically ill, that would be 163,000 needing intensive care. So we don't even have the beds for that.
Okay, so that's a lot to absorb there. We're trying to get not time out the repeater there. So let's just stop there for a bit, and we'll take some questions. So again, that's the sort of the how bad is it part and a little bit of the impact as numbers grow. So do you have any questions for Sheila here? I'll pass them on. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. You have Emergency Preparedness Net on the 529. Yes, sir. Go ahead, Richard.
That is correct. So what we have calculated is that, or the way to think about it is if you don't do anything about this, each person that has it passes it on to about another 2.5 people. The more we socially distance, the fewer people each person can pass it on to. And so when people have to be further apart, that helps a bit. Don't have big groups, it helps. Anything that you do that moves people apart, it drops it a little bit. The problem is that there's a lot of cases out there right now that are doing that rapid expansion that I talked about. And so what we're finding is what we initially said was, you know, just wash your hands really well, stay a little bit far apart. That's not working. So then you get stopping groups of 250, and then you get stopping groups of 50, and then so on. And that's because the mathematicians in the world are busy chomping numbers, and they pretty much decided not quite a week ago that if we don't do close to full quarantine, we may not be able to stop this from overwhelming our hospital and healthcare system. So let me take a brief break and explain why that's so bad, because it's not always apparent. I mean, clearly it's bad in that if you get COVID-19, you won't be able to get the care you need, and if you don't get the care you need, if there's no hospital bed and you're 7 years old and you get COVID-19, your odds of dying go up. But in the process of doing that, it basically shuts down healthcare for everything. So right now, many hospitals in the country have already stopped all elective surgery. They are starting to pull primary care doctors out of clinics to come work in the hospitals. And as it gets bigger and bigger, we basically can't provide even routine medical care. So if you, under the kind of a drastic one, if you had a heart attack in the middle of COVID-19, you're going to be competing with all those COVID-19 people for a hospital bed, and you might not get one.
Okay, so Richard, did that? Do you have a follow-up question, or does anyone else have a follow-up question? I guess what we want you to understand is that I think I've talked about this before, and Sheila mentioned this. There's old articles about what is a disaster and what is an emergency. Okay, so we have we're really, really good in this country for emergencies. Emergencies mean you have lots of resources and you can bring them to bear on any particular problem that comes up. That's when you have all the resources. Resources can be people, they can be supplies, they can be buildings, they can be lots of things. They can be radio operators, okay? They're all resources, okay? When we have the resources, and even on a big event, we have an emergency. So what is the definition of a disaster? A disaster is when we don't have enough resources. So you can see here that actually the definition of this, by that, what we're having right now, is a disaster because we don't have the resources. Okay? Any follow-up questions? Is it Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, or other questions? Yes, sir, Richard. Go ahead, please.
W7NAT.
Okay, we'll do. I heard you there, Nate. I'll put you on the. You're on the deck, as they say in the baseball world. Let's get Richard's questions answered briefly, and then we'll come to Nate.
That's what I was here for.
Let it go unchecked. Most of the people in the United States, well, actually not most, probably 60-70% would get infected within the course of the year. But by then, we would have lost all health care and everything long before that. By instituting social distancing, we are going to drastically decrease the number of people that get infected, like drastically. It might be down to 5% or so, which creates the next difficulty of if we do all of this and then we let people back out again, aren't they just going to get sick? And that's what our governmental systems are just coming to grips with. That may very well happen. Both pandemics come in waves. You have one that lasts for 3 to 6 months, and then you get another one when it gets back out in the community and gets another round of people. We're just grasping that, and plans aren't good for it, except for the fact that I can tell you if we can buy time by allowing our hospital systems to continue functioning for the next couple months, then we're also buying time to try and figure out how we can handle making our country continue without this keeping happening every few months. So we're buying time and trying to keep the healthcare system working while we try and figure out. Worst case scenario, we're all going to be doing this social isolation for maybe 18 months until we have a vaccine that works.
Okay, so hopefully let's move on to Nate. He had a question there. Go ahead, Nate.
Well, I was relating to that half of the United States getting it. That was due to Joe Biden, and he didn't seem to know what he was talking about.
I really don't listen to any of the politicians right now, so I can just tell you from a epidemiology point of view that, yes, if this were to continue spreading based upon its infectiousness, if we didn't do anything to stop that, yes, probably we know from basic the way that epidemics and pandemics work, if we don't do anything to slow down the infection rate, roughly 60 to 70% of the population will be infected with the first round. By then, there's so many people that hopefully are immune, the virus doesn't find as many people out there to infect. The number that each person that's infected can then infect drops, and a pandemic goes away. So with no treatment, and this has been studied throughout the years, with no treatment, a pandemic has a huge peak, often affecting 60-plus percent of the population, and then it fades because the virus doesn't have enough victims for a while. And then anywhere from a few months to a few years later, it tends to do that again. And so I don't know about Biden, but that's the basic way pandemics and epidemics have worked in everybody that studied them.
W7RGM.
Okay, let's break here for this. Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. There's Reiner. I'll check you in. Whiskey Golf 7, Romeo Golf Mike. Got you. Is there anybody else want to check in real quick? We are, again, this is Mercy Preparedness, and we have Sheila Sund, MD. She's here to answer some questions about the COVID-19 and talk about, the facts that, based on her years of experience of studying pandemics and advising on state advisory groups and things. Reiner, anybody else want to check in? I got you there, Reiner.
Whiskey Bravo 6, Sugar Roger Peter.
Okay, that's Ben, Whiskey Bravo 6, Sierra Romeo Papa. Got you on there. Any other quick check-ins? Okay, very good. Now, Reiner, did you have a question or a comment?
Yes. My call sign is W7RGM, first of all. I think you added a G in there somewhere. And then my question is, and we may have already covered this, but I got in a little bit late. What percentage of the people that contract the disease are asymptomatic, A, and B, what percentage of people that contract the disease are actually going to get to the need of a hospital and that type of care, that level of care?
What you're asking are questions that we're still trying to figure out from the scientific community, originally from what was happening in China, where the data is better than you would expect, but still not full. But also now we have some countries that Singapore, South Korea, things like that, where we're getting additional data that have been fighting this a bit longer now. The newest information, which really just came out in a study in the last couple days, is that there may be 5 people completely asymptomatic for every one person that develops symptoms. They're all infected. They're all infectious, meaning that they can infect other people, but it may be as much as 5 people of that are infecting people with no symptoms whatsoever, and that's one of the reasons that we think the virus is spreading so rapidly. That way, you don't know who in your community could be infecting somebody unless you can test everybody, and we all know testing isn't working very well so far. So that's what we can tell you as far as why we're trying to do so much social distancing, because we think there are a lot of people out there with minimal or no symptoms who are still infecting others, not through their fault. They don't know that they're sick. As far as severe illness, those are based upon people that have been sick enough or been picked up for some reason by testing. So from all the people that have been identified as having it, which is clearly not everybody that has it, but from all the people that have been identified that is having it, a little less than 20% are ending up in the hospital, and about one quarter to one third of those require intensive care and ventilation, which is why, again, we need to do everything possible to cut the numbers down, because trying to take care of that much load on the hospital system won't just make it impossible to take care of COVID-19. It will make it impossible to take care of any health care in this country. And that's why you're seeing such stringent measures. If we can slow it down, we can save our health care system while we try and figure out what to do about it in the longer term.
RGM.
Yes, Ryan, go ahead.
Yeah, from what I have heard of the Korean study, and I guess they've tested over 1 million people with a more accurate test than is being used, except maybe in Germany, their lethality rate was at 0.5%. Now, is that a different number because they're identifying more of these asymptomatic people, or am I incorrect in my numbers, first of all? But is that part of it that shows the difference between, yes, these people are sick and so many are dying of them, or we didn't even know these people were sick and only a smaller percentage is actually lethal?
It's mostly the second, yes. There are a few countries, interesting, it's Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan. These countries actually suffered horribly from the first coronavirus, which was SARS, back in the early 2000s. And as a result, they have very, very good systems in place already to try and deal with this type of thing. So from the very beginning, they have jumped on every single case. They break a lot of rules as far as privacy that we don't follow in our country. So if you get tested, if you have any symptom at all in South Korea, you will get tested within a matter of hours. You drive up and you get a test. After you are tested, they will have a result within a very short amount of time, and then they have a huge team of people that will track all of your movements based upon your phone and everything else like that. They will publish that, and they will hunt down everybody that came in contact with you for several days, and all of that group will be quarantined for 14 days. So that's how they're controlling it. And yes, if you do that, they've managed to cut it down to actually not very many cases, and they're identifying tons and tons of people that are infected without knowing about it. And so, yeah, those groups, it's not a very high fatality rate. Everywhere else in the world is only identifying people that are pretty much sick already, you know, that they have some degree of symptoms. It could be mild, it could be severe. And in that group, if you take anybody with symptoms enough to come to anybody's attention enough to get a test, that's where the high hospitalization and fatality rate is. But even in that very limited group, it's enough to shut down healthcare.
WA911.
Yes, David, go ahead, please.
Okay, so let's move on to being sick. According to the Washington Health stuff that we get, coronavirus basically has three things: a temperature, a cough, and a shortness of breath. Do you know if there's a pattern to how that is? Is there a sequence? And when we say temperature, what does a temperature mean if I were to measure my temperature? Do you know any of these things? This is WA911.
That's what we used for screening initially, and as we learn more and more about it from the cases that didn't come to official attention, we're realizing that those are very poor ways to screen for disease. They've now shown that many people that were screened based upon symptoms and temperature, like all the temperature checks they were doing at businesses and airports, it doesn't work. So we know that people can have no symptoms. We know that they can have mild symptoms that just feel like they're coming down with the flu or a cold. And then we have people that have the classic symptoms, which is a fever of like a degree more than what you would normally run. The reason that's not terribly helpful is young people get fevers really easily. Older people don't mount fevers very well. So an older person, and this is not just from COVID-19, an older person that has a temperature of 99.9 could be very sick. And that, for a young person, you barely would even blink at. So temperatures don't work. The new recommendation is if you feel sick, act like you have it. Which means that you should really basically quarantine yourself until you are completely asymptomatic. Is that long enough? We don't know. But since we can't test, if you feel sick, I can't tell whether you have seasonal flu, which is still out there, whether you have a cold, or whether you have COVID-19. If you're better in a day or two, the odds are it was a cold. If you're better in 3 or 4 days, odds are it was the flu. If you're sick for 5 to 7 or longer days, probably have COVID-19, but I can't prove that. So the current recommendation is simply quarantine yourself for at least 24 hours after you have any symptoms. My personal recommendation is quarantine yourself for 14 days.
RGM.
And let me identify this Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and we have Sheila Santieri. That's a third party. Take your questions. Go ahead, Reiner.
Well, when you classify people as young and old, where are we talking age group-wise or fitness-wise or whatever as far as these groups? I mean, are we talking infants? Are we talking toddlers? Are we talking preschool, school age? Are we talking 80, 70, 60, 50 years old, health-wise, all that kind of stuff?
Again, it's a constantly evolving thing. What I tell you today may be shown differently in a week from now based upon research, but currently we believe that children and teenagers are infected at the same rate as everybody else, but that they are asymptomatic the majority of the time. And so kids and teens get it, but they show no symptoms, they pass it on. Even in the 20s, people in their 20s, they've shown, are far less likely to end up in the hospital. By the time people get into their 30s, they're starting to require hospitalization and even intensive care fairly frequently, but if they receive those services, they recover. The fatality rates, there are people that die and have clearly died in their 30s, 40s, 50s, but the fatality rates statistically start to pick up in their 60s. By the time, again, the numbers may be wrong, but the trend is the same. By the time people are in their 70s, in the earliest data from China, which is all we really have as a big study, the fatality rates were about up to 8% of everybody that got sick in their 70s. And in the 80 and above group, about 15% of the people were dying that were identified as infected.
KK7ART.
Yes, Art. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I had a couple questions. I mean, people that are getting sick and are recovering, what is their level of immunity after that? Are they going to be immune to coronavirus for life, or is this going to be like the flu where a slightly different version is going to come around next year and they're going to be dealing with it all over again? And the second question is, I've heard recently that some of the people who have recovered from coronavirus are having what seems to be long-term lung damage from the infection. Is that accurate to the best of your knowledge? And thank you for being on the net. I sure appreciate it. This has been a great conversation. KK7ART.
So the first question about immunity, that is really the golden ticket question, and there isn't an answer right now. We are assuming that it's going to act like other coronaviruses, which usually mean that you have reasonable immunity at least for a year or two. Coronaviruses that are common in humans actually make up a fair amount of the people that get colds. And we do know that if you're infected with a coronavirus that causes a cold, you probably won't get a cold from that coronavirus again for a year or two. So we're hoping that COVID-19 at least act like that. But right now, it's just a hope. We have no knowledge currently of immunity, okay? We don't even have 100% knowledge of whether a positive test turning negative means that you don't have it anymore. This is all information we should be able to gather fairly quickly over the next month or two, but we don't have it right now. So every scientist out there is going, geez, I pray that people get immunity to this. But we honestly don't know.
K7JCD.
Okay, let's see. Let's check John in here real quick. Let's see, I think we missed the second part of Art's question. So let me get John checked in. Art, what was the second part of the question?
I heard just in the last day or two that some of the people that were recovered and seem to not be having symptoms anymore and aren't testing positive anymore seem to have some sort of lasting or potentially lasting lung damage, and I was wondering if that was accurate or if the doctor knew anything about that. Thanks again, KK7ART.
I haven't read a lot of evidence one way or the other from that. Knowing, however, the pattern of this infection, it wouldn't surprise me that that there will be a subset of people that may very well have long-term lung damage. This is an infection that actually happens in the air spaces, the most, you know, tiniest little parts. And we do know that infections and problems in those air spaces from other diseases can cause long-term problems with the lungs being able to expand and contract as well as they should or exchange air as well as they should. So I haven't seen any definitive answers about this, but it wouldn't surprise me if there are going to be people, particularly those who have ended up on ventilators, who are going to have some degree of long-term pulmonary problems as a result of this.
Okay, now I also had John in there. John, did you have a question, or did you just want to check in?
Well, I just wanted to check in. Listening to the discussion, I missed about the first half hour, but so I don't know what's been talked about. But I was wondering, what's the false negative rate on these different types of tests that they're using, and how many successive independent negatives do you need to get a, you know, some numerical confidence that the person actually doesn't have it anymore?
Unfortunately, that's also a bit of an unknown. We are starting to hear some reports coming out in the medical literature of people that have tested negative and then have turned positive again. We also clearly know that there are people that test negative early on who then turn positive. In order to know that, you would have to study people sequentially, and that's not happening yet. Right now, we are just going with kind of random, whoever gets tested, let's figure out what their symptoms are. Again, I think over the next 3 to 6 months, behind all the societal and hospital horror, the scientists are busy trying to gain as much information as they can, and literally every week we're finding more data out. But right now, I would just say that if it's caught too early, you will be negative and could still turn positive. Once you are actively infectious, you are definitely going to be positive. At some point in time, you might start turning negative again. Whether that means yet that you're completely clear or not is not well known.
RGM.
Reiner, go ahead, please.
So is this titer testing or some other methodology? And then my other half had a question about what they consider shortness of breath. She had seen something about not being able to hold your breath more than 10 seconds or something on the internet, so I didn't know if that was anything to actually go on or not.
As far as the testing, it's based mostly on looking. They have a procedure they can do which actually finds virus particles and then gets amplified enough that they can pick them up. So they're actually measuring virus particles. Whether those are live virus particles or Clearly, if they're alive, you have a live virus in you and you're infected, you have virus particles, the test will be positive. But if it drops down to where you only have a couple live viruses, will it go negative? Don't know. There's also some questions about whether, even if you've killed all the virus, they may have leftover particles floating around in your system for a while that will still make the test positive. But that's what they're looking for. They are have this way of amplifying it so they can find very low levels of virus particles in your body. As far as the shortness of breath, actually the best thing I could tell you is to know what your current exercise capacity is and look for a change. So if you get short of breath walking up the stairs right now, if you would be getting short of breath with walking up a half a flight of stairs. You know, that is the single earliest thing to tell you that you have a change is that fairly abruptly your exercise tolerance will not be as good. However, we have to realize you can be infected long before you have any symptoms. You can be infected and have no symptoms. In the United States, with our current testing guidelines, basically, if you have any symptom whatsoever, consider yourself infected. That doesn't mean you can go to the hospital and get tested for it. We're a ways away from that still. But you have to act as if you're infected if you have any symptom whatsoever. Cold, flu, more shortness of breath, a little bit of a fever, anything that feels like more than allergies. For right now, the safest thing for those you love is to assume that you are infected and go put yourself in quarantine in your house with no human contact until you feel better for 24 hours. Horrible to say, but until we get more testing, that's the best we have.
JLO. Jeff, go ahead, please. Yes, KA7JLO, Jeff in Albany here. Question, do you have any handle on, or local health community have any handle on when the drive-through testing might become available, and why should I go get tested?
I think based upon the inside scoop, there will be some drive-through testing that becomes available probably within the week. However, it is still going to be fairly limited. The results are not going to come back very quickly. And really, at this point in time, we're not going to be set up for trying to test people that just wonder whether they have it or not because they don't feel good. Even for quite a while, maybe, I don't know what a quite a while is, I'm guessing another couple weeks at least, there's not going to be testing for people that are not pretty sick. So in the meantime, you have to just treat it as if you are, because we really do need the tests for people that are sick so that we can decide what healthcare needs to do to keep themselves safe while they take care of them. So if you're not sick enough to, like, be thinking maybe I should be in the hospital, right now, if you went and tried to get testing, that would just burden the system.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We have the emergency preparedness net, and tonight we're talking about COVID-19, and we have Sheila Sund, MD, who worked again on the state planning pandemic committee a few years ago and preparing for these kinds of things. She's retired now and here to answer your questions based on her reading, which she's been doing ever since it was first announced back in January that this was starting. So anyway, this is a good chance to, she has a handle on most of the facts, which do change. You look back in the last couple of weeks, we had, just a few cases of people, now we have more. We have had just a few rules, now we have more, okay? So anybody have any other questions? Maybe you're wondering, why is it that, all the restaurants have closed or, what can you do? What could you do for, to help it from spreading around in your community or, what can we do to help people who may not have, a way to go get, supplies or something. But questions like that are fine, too.
CGC.
Yes, Mike, go ahead, please.
Yes. My wife and I, being 80 plus years old and having COPD and other underlying health issues, have been quarantined now for over 2 weeks. And we're fairly well, prepared. We're okay. We got enough canned beef. But I'm wondering, like the mail, and if we were to order in, say, from Amazon, a bag of or a case of dried beans, how long does the virus live on the mail and on the shipment from Amazon? Over.
That's a very good question, because I think there's two ways to think about getting the virus. One is getting the virus from somebody else directly. That's where the social distancing comes in. If you sit in a restaurant, yes, you could get it. If you sit in an enclosed room with somebody that has it, yes, you can get it. Those are actually all high risks, and a lot of the infections have come from people in those settings. Less of the infections, but still some of them, seem to be coming from picking up the droplets on your hands. We do know that virus particles can live for hours and maybe a number of days on surfaces. But the good news is if you do extremely good hand washing and disinfecting, you should not get sick from those. So if you had food delivered from the grocery store or from Amazon, what I recommend people do is that they have a hot zone, basically, at the entrance to their house, and anything that comes from the outside world stops there, whether that's a box or a grocery bag or your purse or your shoes. It doesn't go beyond that into your house. From there, you take your groceries or your packages, and you put the contents directly into your cabinets so they're not contaminating your the counters at all, and then you wash your hands, okay? You wash your hands really well. If you have a disinfectant wipe and you can wipe off the outside of the bag of beans or whatever you have before you put it into your cabinet, even better. If you do that, you basically, and you've scrubbed your hands for 20 seconds after putting the beans in your cabinet, you're fine for this. When it comes time to make dinner, when you take the stuff out, avoid putting it on your counters as much as possible, but make your food the way you need to have to, and then before you eat, you wash those hands again incredibly well. We do know that hand washing actually destroys the
time out. Timer, cancel.
Okay, sorry, we timed out there. How much did we get cut off there? This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Did you hear the tips on how to bring it into the room? There, Mike. Okay, very good. So let's see. So, again, the packaging is, you know, is not is a low risk, but we treat it as dirty. We're just being very, very mindful about, you know, washing our hands and not eating with our hands. I think the bigger problem that people will run into is not the stuff delivered to home, although it's safe to have stuff delivered to your house and treat it like that, okay? But those people who go out, I mean, it's going to be really difficult to change your habit of going to the fast food restaurant in your car, you know, and ordering the, you know, as McDonald's said, a bag for the road. You know, get that bag of French fries and start munching it as you drive down the road. You can't do that, okay? Unless you can wash your hands. I would kind of avoid eating with your hands anyway. But, you know, French fries themselves, they're going to be in boiling oil. There's no virus on them. The problem is that you handled the door of the car, you've, you know, handed your credit card over maybe to the people or gotten money back. You know, your hands are contaminated. You do not want to eat with your hands until your hands are really washed well, 20 or 30 seconds worth of washing, you know, soap and water, not just hand sanitizer, okay? Any, did we answer your question there, Mike?
Yeah, Roger, Roger. It's, I've been told that the virus can live, like, on cardboard for, like, 2 days. So that's an interesting kind of thing that maybe a Lysol spray or something could take care of that. What do you think about that, lady?
I mean, there's probably no way we can be 100% germ-free. The fewer people that have touched something before you, the odds go way down. So buying something at a grocery store is going to be much more contaminated than buying something from Amazon. But in any of those circumstances, yes, if you can use a Lysol safely on the container, you know, if you use it on something that's just going to disintegrate the container, that's not going to work. But if you can use Lysol on a container, you do that. Can you use Lysol on fruits and vegetables? No. But the chances are of COVID being buried in a fruit or vegetable as well, because it would take somebody's hands to have, like, kind of played in the contents of your vegetables, not very likely. So I want to encourage people to do excessive hand washing, but I also don't want you to feel like every surface in the world is waiting to get you.
RGM.
PC.
Okay, let me get the follow-up from Mike, and then Reiner's next.
Yeah, vegetables, I know as a certified executive chef, ACS, that vegetables can be washed with soap, a light soap and water, and I highly recommend that, no matter what it is.
Okay, good. And Reiner, you have another question?
Well, two, one point of information. I have been told by someone whose sister is a postmaster general that the post office is wearing gloves and required to sanitize every 2 hours. So your mail has probably not been exposed to anything recently anyway, but that doesn't mean somebody didn't cough on it at the post office. And then I was wondering if that kind of thing, like mail and packages you bring in your house, if you just let them set 2 days in your hot zone area, are you pretty safe handling them after that?
We don't know what the magic number is. If you want to use the approach of I'm just not going to handle it, I'd probably wait at least 3 days based upon what we know. But again, you know, if you handle things and then you wash your hands well after that, you're fine. That's the biggest thing, is you can handle things. You just don't want to put them on things where you're then going to touch them without thinking about it. And after you're done handling them, you need to wash your hands really well. As far as the soap on vegetables, smooth surface, apples, oranges, potatoes, great. Rough surfaces, you're not going to be able to clean them adequately. I mean, can you imagine trying to get soap into all the crevices of broccoli? So in those circumstances, if you really want to be cautious, you could cook it. But also, I am not aware of any cases that have actually been transmitted on food yet.
Okay, we're kind of reaching the top of the hour here. Again, there's maybe we should just kind of reiterate as things are changing here. We kind of got this rapid changes in rules for us. And what we tried to explain a little earlier is that as people are looking at the numbers and how these curves work, things build quickly, and if we don't start doing something, that you know, we're going to overwhelm the medical system. So that's why things are changing from, oh, well, it's not that big of a deal, to now suddenly you can't you know, gather in crowds and restaurants are closed and things like that. So that's really unsettling to have that happen. But let me just see if there's any questions about, you know, why any of these rules, whether they, you have any questions of why they instituted a particular rule, or, you know, if that standpoint.
RGM.
Yeah, go ahead, Reiner.
I know I've had a lot of questions, and I really appreciate the fact that you're there to answer them. But one more. What soap do you recommend as far as people are going to wash their hands a lot? That's hard on the skin and everything. Do you use a hand soap? Do you use a dish soap like Dawn, which really breaks up grease and stuff? Or what does she recommend for that?
Anything that's listed as a hand soap is fine. It doesn't have to be antibacterial. If it's listed as a hand soap, it has detergent in it. If you run out of hand soap, anything that's listed as detergent will work. The biggest thing is that you need a lot of hand lotion as well. That's how hospital workers have survived with all the hand washing over the last 20 years that we've been doing this, is you just have to put lotion on your hands. Almost every time you wash your hands, you wash them really well, and then you throw on some lotion. The last thing I wanted to just throw out there is no matter what the rules are, it really comes down to everybody doing their best. The more you can social distance, the more we can save our healthcare system, and ultimately that's what it's going to take to survive this as a community, a state, and a country.
Okay, well, I think we're just about out of time here. I got the time at 8:02. Again, we've put there's a website that has this COVID-19, how bad is it? This is Sheila's blog. She'll be blogging more regularly now. There's also some good older emergency preparedness articles, which she's written in the past. You can look back at the her discussion about H1N1 from a couple years ago. She's got stuff on there about you know, other kinds of emergency preparedness, particularly, you know, earthquakes and fires and various other kinds of things. So it's a good resource for emergency preparedness in general. So disaster.net is the name of the website. If anybody needs a fill on how I suppose, just like it sounds, one word, disaster.net. Okay, so that, take a look at that blog if you can. Okay, let me get a drip and we'll close the net here.
CDC, one more question.
TRS.
Can we get an answer on what's the high temperature that will kill this virus?
Okay, so there was a double there. So we have CPC said, what's the high temperature known to kill the virus, like in cooking up food or, you know, using hot water? Is that what you mean?
Roger, roger.
Okay, and that was a double with you. Let me just double check. Who's the double?
Kilo India 7, Tango Romeo Fox.
Okay, Cody, did you got Skila India 7, Tango Romeo Foxtrot, Cody there? Let's see. I'll check you in. We're going to take this quick question. Sheila can come back next week and answer more questions for you. Or we can come back on another net as needed, but I don't want to keep people too late here. Let's have her answer the question about the heat killing the virus here.
Nobody's looked at it very specifically, but everything about this virus suggests that it would be killed by all the normal food preparation rules that we have. You know, so you cook it just the way you always would. Don't cook your vegetables. If you're going to do meat, if it's a ground meat where the virus could be in the inside, you know, cook it well. But just follow standard food safety and you will be fine with COVID-19.
Thank you, Doctor.
Dennis Mountry.
I'm sorry, I doubled with you there. Who was that again? Go ahead. Let me go ahead and close the net, and of course you guys can discuss around your roundtable on your own there. But the time is now 8:06 p.m., and this concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. This net has been meeting each Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on 145.29 megahertz. And our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thanks to the 25 people who checked in tonight, and thanks to those who stood by to give us a clear channel. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and our guest, Sheila Sund, MD. Closing the net at 8:06 p.m., we now return the repeater to normal undirected amateur operations. Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, I am clear.
Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Brett, I have a question for you. Was this session recorded tonight? And if so, will it be available on the Internet? KA7JLO.
Okay, KG7GDB, let's, yeah, I think, Richard, EDF, if you're still there, maybe you could figure out how to get Broadcastify. I know you've done this before. I don't know if you recorded it tonight. I did not record it, but, Richard, are you there? Okay, very good. Yeah, thank you. So let's see, maybe if people want, I don't know how you've done that in the past, but perhaps if you could, you know, we have the WA7ABU at groups.io for that you might be able to post that to. The other thing is that we gave you that website. There is a contact thing there for questions. She answers her email if you says contact her. And you can click on that disaster.doc.net website and ask any questions away, and then maybe we can. Okay, yeah, she'll, again, she's just mentioned that if it's a, you know, if it's a personal question, she'll keep that confidential. If it's a general question, it might be answered in the form of a blog post, questions and answer kind of thing.
Well, Brett, there was just a ton of incredibly good information that was in all the questions that were asked tonight. I wasn't scribbling down rapid notes, so I was just I thought it would be nice if I had some place where I could go back and review all the questions and the answer and the preamble. Thank you very much, Sheila. Really appreciate what you did for us tonight on the net, KA7JLO.
Who is doubling, but maybe they can identify and come on.
Yeah, there's double about every time you talk.